All right, repeat after me. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day, for those gathered here and those far away, for the time we share with love and care. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day.
Good morning. My name is Michael Oldfather. It's my pleasure to host this Labor Day service. The first Labor Day celebration occurred in New York City in 1892. No, that's wrong. Not is earlier than that. It's 1882. Similar events quickly spread across the country. In 1894, Congress unanimously voted to establish the first Monday of September as a legal holiday for federal government employees, honoring the country's workers, women and men alike. Very early on in election years, the holiday became a venue for political candidates to kick off their campaigns. After months of eager anticipation, we will finally witness the long-awaited beginning of speeches, advertising, letters, emails, etc., of the several men and women who want to be our next president at long last. So whatever work you do or used to do, you are welcome here. Whichever candidate you support for president, as well as other offices, you are welcome here, and your opinions on the subject, however misguided they may be, will be honored without exception, just as we respect each other's ethnicity, life stories, religious convictions or lack thereof, sexual orientation, and pretty much every other way in which we may differ from one another. Besides working with Reverend Johnstone to organize this morning's service, my duties extend to being responsible for starting and ending on time. In addition, my job description includes reminding people who speak from the audience to wait for the microphone and to hold it like this, about this far from your lips. Keep it there, roughly parallel to the ground, and it will come through for people who are wearing headsets and for the recording that folks who will listen to the program later. And if you are able to keep your insights and wisdom succinct, that will earn you lots of friends, lots of them. All right. We're going to make a few changes in the order. For one thing, we're going to reverse the announcements and lighting the chalice, so that comes next. And then a little later in the program, the offertory will be preceded by the reading of the Song of the Shirt, and everything else will mostly proceed as we have it listed there. So, of the announcements, John Alou, do you want to go first? Well, I'll go first, and then you can come right now. Well, no, we're going to light the... We're going to light the chalice. All right, my chalice lighter. More than 20 years ago, at a Labor Day weekend Sunday service here, longtime member Evelyn Fraser quoted Helen Keller's thoughts on work. Here are those words, once more, with which to light the chalice in honor of two extraordinary women. I long to accomplish a great and noble task, but it is my chief duty to accomplish humble tasks as though they were great and noble. The world has moved along not only by the mighty shoves of its heroes, but also by the aggregate of tiny pushes of each honest worker. Announcements. I'll go first. All right. One of our innovations for this year is an effort to include a choir anthem or some other kind of special music on as many Sundays as possible. Just as we are a liberal religion, you will see that our definition of special music is liberal too. And you are invited to volunteer now.
So what the heck does Covenant have to do with Labor Day? You might be asking that as you look at this morning's order of service. Well, beginning this month, we're entering a new way of engaging together through theme-based ministry. And you might have seen it in the newsletter, which starts with Covenant also and is out there on the front table. So while themes will shape what we do together on Sunday morning, they will not dictate or limit our offerings. Instead, themes give us a lens on our lives, both in the fellowship and in the larger world. Our goal is to live with the themes, see where they lead, what questions they raise, and live into our answers rather than simply think our way through them. So it's experience-based. One way to engage in this month's theme is to pick up a copy of our covenant, which I think is still out there in the narthex somewhere. And if you want to learn more, you can come to our Chalice Circle Facilitator Training, no obligation, next Sunday at 3, or watch for sign-ups later this month and join a Chalice Circle. And in the meantime, back to Sunday mornings. One way we want to live into our theme is to learn a single hymn each month that will reflect that theme and sing that hymn through the month. And this month's hymn is number 129, Let Love Continue Long. It may be unfamiliar to you, but if you're here regularly, you'll have a different sense of it and connect with the covenant that we all share. So,
please stand as you are able and join us for the initial singing. I don't think we've ever sung it before. 129, Let Love Continue Long. We now devote some time for people to express passages in their lives, their joys, their concerns that they wish to share with us. And we ask that you wait for the microphone to come to you and then say what you will say.
This isn't a passage in my life, but about this hymn we're introducing, which I think is very nice, but it would have been easier if it had been played through once first. And then, of course, we're getting more repetition.
Susan Adamchak, many of you probably know that Betty and her husband are both recovering from pneumonia this week, so just please keep them in your thoughts.
Chris Bailey, and though you never see my wife Sandy here of a Sunday. I have a joy today that 12 years ago, Sandy and I got married.
All right.
Sabrina Boker, a friend of mine, Sharon, her daughter was pregnant. She was only 17, real slight, but she lost the baby, so that's a concern today. But and my brother also, he's recovering from a chest cold, so he's getting better. Thank you.
Larry Weaver, continuing Chris Bailey's thought, one of the wonderful things about being married for a long time is all the history that you share. And in 3 days, Dick and Judy Cattell will celebrate their 65th wedding anniversary.
All right.
Way to go.
Well, thank you for sharing. Oh, for those of you who have thoughts that you have kept to yourselves, we join with you as best as we can in support of you. Now, story for all ages. Children are of all ages are invited to come forward.
This morning, I have a story for you from India. And this story is about a king who was very, very rich. He was very, very rich because he taxed the people so much. He taxed their houses, and he taxed their horses, and he taxed their crops, and he just taxed everything. But that means that he had a lot. He had a huge palace. He had all kinds of food. He had all kinds of servants. It was really a very lovely life. And then along came a hunter and his dog. Now, this king loved hunting, and this hunter was very skilled, and so he was glad to have him come, and he was glad to host him. But now this dog was something special. He was so big, his paws were like the size of dinner plates, and his head was like the size of a beach ball. And when he barked, it was really, really loud, like thunder. It was huge. Anyway, this hunter came with his dog, and the king was happy to see him, happy to greet him. But the dog started barking, 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 barking. And the king said, "How do we get this dog quiet?" And the hunter said, "He's hungry." Well, now that seems reasonable. So the king got his servants to bring a big plate of the best meat that you could imagine and set it in front of the dog. And the dog gobbled it down. And as long as the dog was eating, he stopped barking. But as soon as the meat was gone, he was barking again. How do we stop this dog from barking? He's hungry. Give him more meat. So they brought more meat. And the dog ate all that meat. And then started barking again. It was so loud that nobody could hear themselves talk to each other. They could hardly hear themselves think, it was so loud. So the king kind of yelled at the hunter, "What is wrong with this dog? Why doesn't he stop barking?" The hunter says, Oh, it's because this dog is hungry as long as anybody in the kingdom is hungry." Uh-oh. The king said, "There are people in the kingdom who are hungry?" "Yeah. Well, what are we going to do?" And he got his advisors together and he said, "What can we do?" And somebody said, "Well, we could kill the dog." But nobody wanted to kill the dog. They weren't going to do that. They said, "We could send away the hunter." Well, they tried that, and the hunter said, "No, I'm supposed to be here." So he wouldn't leave. The dog wouldn't leave. What were they going to do? Give the person who's hungry food, but they don't know what person's hungry, and maybe it's more than one. So they got carts, long carts, and filled it with food and sent it out to all the villages around. And the dog kept barking through all of this, but there was enough commotion that the sound didn't sound quite so loud. They sent out all the carts all to all the villages and all around, and everybody got food all over the kingdom. And finally, the dog quit barking. And that's how they knew everybody in the kingdom now had food. Now, the dog didn't go away for a little while because he wanted to make sure that that king made sure that all his people kept having food. But after a few years, the dog wandered on off. And the king had learned his lesson that unless everybody is fed, we can't all be content. And so, you all are invited to go to your classes.
Now, the Song of the Shirt. Thomas Hood was a very popular English poet who lived not a long time. He died in, he was born in 1799, died in 1845. Very, as I say, very popular, widely read. So this poem, which is regarded as one of his bestsellers, suits this occasion, I think. The Song of the Shirt. With fingers weary and worn, with eyelids heavy and red, a woman sat in unwomanly rags, plying her needle and thread, stitch, 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 in poverty, hunger, and dirt, and still with a voice of dolorous pitch, she sang the song of the shirt. Work, 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 while the cock is growing aloof, and work, 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 till the stars shine through the roof. Oh, to be a slave along the barber with the barbarous Turk, where woman has never a soul to save, if this is Christian work. Work, 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 till the brain begins to swim. Work, 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 till the eyes are heavy and dim. Seam and gusset and band, band and gusset and seam, till over the buttons I fall asleep and sew them on in a dream. O men with sisters dear, O men with mothers and wives, it is not linen you're wearing out, but human creatures' lives. Stitch, stitch, stitch. In poverty, hunger, and dirt, sewing at once with a double thread, a shroud as well as a shirt. But why do I talk of death? That phantom of grisly bone, I hardly fear its terrible shape. It seems so like my own. It seems so like my own because of the fasts I keep. O God, that bread should be so dear and flesh and blood so cheap. Work, work, work. My labor never flags. But what are its wages? A bed of straw, a crust of bread, and rags. That shattered roof and this naked floor, a table, a broken chair, and a wall so blank my shadow I thank for sometimes falling there. Work, work, work. From heavy chime to chime, from weary chime to chime, work, 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 as prisoners work for crime, band and gusset and seam, seam and gusset and band, till the heart is sick and the brain benumbed, as well as the weary hand. Work, 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 in the dull December light, and work, 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 when the weather is warm and bright, while underneath the eaves the brooding swallows cling, as if to show me their sunny backs and twit me with the spring. But oh, oh, but to breathe the breath of the cowslip and primrose sweet, with the sky above my head and the grass beneath my feet, for only one short hour, to feel as I used to feel before I knew the woes of want and the walk that costs a meal. Oh, but for one short hour, a respite however brief, no blessed leisure for love or hope, but only time for grief. A little weeping would ease my heart, but in their briny bed my tears must stop, for every drop hinders needle and thread. With fingers weary and worn, with eyelids heavy and red, a woman sat in unwomanly rags, plying her needle and thread. Stitch, stitch, stitch. In poverty, hunger, and dirt, and still with a voice of dolorous pitch, would that its tone would reach the rich, she sang the song of the shirt. Now it's time for the offering. We do have a bit of endowment, but it doesn't throw off nearly enough money to keep this thing going. When I selected this song for special music, I didn't know that Saturday morning, sitting at the breakfast table, I would feel the earth move for all the wrong reasons. And but this story is based on true events about a very bad collapse of a mine. In the town of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, down in the dark of the Cumberland mine, there's blood on the coal and the miners lie. In the roads that never saw sun nor sky, roads that never saw sun nor sky. In the town of Spring Hill you don't sleep easy, often the earth will tremble and roll. When the earth gets restless, miners die. Bone and blood is the price of coal. Bone and blood is the price of coal. In the town of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia, late in the spring of 58, day still comes and the sun still shines. But it's dark as the grave in the Cumberland mine, dark as the grave in the Cumberland mine. Down at the coal face, miners working, rattle of the belt and the cutter's blade. Rumble of rock and the walls close round. The living and the dead men 2 miles down, living and the dead men 2 miles down. 12 men lay 2 miles from the pit shaft. 12 men lay in the dark and sang. Long hot days in a miner's tomb. It was 3 feet high and 100 long. 3 feet high and 100 long. 3 days passed and the lamps gave out. And Caleb Rushton, he ups and says, there's no more water or light or bread. So we'll live on songs and hope instead. We'll live on songs and hope instead. Listen for the shouts of the barefaced miners. Listen through the rubble for a rescue team. 600 feet of coal and slag. Hope imprisoned in a 3-foot seam. Hope imprisoned in a 3-foot seam. 8 long days and some were rescued, leaving the dead to lie alone. Through all their lives they dug their graves. 2 miles of stone for a mark, 2 miles of earth for a marking stone. 2 miles of earth for a marking stone. Comment on wage stagnation. For about 50 years following the end of World War II, U.S. workers experienced a nearly constant annual growth in their wages, roughly equal to the rate of inflation plus another 2% or so, to reflect increases in labor productivity. Since then, average wages have barely kept pace with inflation, and for many, many workers, wages have actually shrunk in terms of buying power. Why has this occurred, and what might be done to reverse this trend? First, union membership. It peaked at 34% of the labor force in the mid-1950s. By 2015, it had fallen to 11.1%. About 35% of public employees are union members, but fewer than 7% of workers in the private sector. Wages for comparable workers tend to be significantly higher for union members, but there is strong evidence that unions also put upward pressure on the earnings of non-unionized workers. Deunionization is surely an important factor in the slowdown in wage growth of the recent past. Reversing this trend seems a little less than probable. Second, trends in minimum wage laws undoubtedly play a role in recent earnings stagnation. It's true that labor economists mostly believe that minimum wage statutes do less harm than their critics allege and provide fewer benefits than their advocates predict. There is a broad consensus, however, that raising the current federal level of $7.25 per hour would do more good than harm. After all, when corrected for inflation, it's about a dollar less than it was in 1968, 48 years ago. Currently, 29 states and the District of Columbia have rates higher than 7.25, and 14 more use the federal rate. There is little evidence that unemployment is higher in the high minimum wage states than elsewhere. Just how much higher the federal rate should and could go is debatable. The highest levels of $11.50 in D.C. and $10 in California and Maryland, overnight increases to these levels nationwide would undoubtedly be somewhat disruptive, especially in low-wage communities and states. The consensus among labor economists is that an initial increase of, say, $1 to $1.50 would be a good place to start, with scheduled increases of perhaps 50 cents a year till reaching a level of $12, at which point annual increases could be and should be indexed to average wage increases. Of course, trying to get this through Congress anytime soon seems a tad improbable, a big tad. I should point out that the U.S. Department of Labor has provided one glimmer of hope for the estimated 4 million low-wage salaried workers covered by minimum wage laws. Currently, employers must pay a minimum weekly salary for non-hourly workers of at least $450. Effective December 1st of this year, that new weekly minimum of covered workers will more than double to $913. Third, economists are still debating why the rate of growth in productivity has fallen so sharply. One story is based on the evidence that labor productivity is highly dependent on the quantity and quality of physical capital available to each worker. The most important source of funding capital investment is corporations' retained earnings. In recent years, the trend has been to devote ever larger portions of corporate profits to dividends and stock buybacks, substantially reducing funds available to increase capital per worker. A complementary story begins with the recognition that the demand for labor is derived from the demand for the product of workers' efforts. If the combined demand of consumers, government, other businesses, and foreign exports, aggregate demand is weak, it doesn't make much sense for businesses to be aggressive about adding employees. And reduced demand for workers tends to work against raising their wages. To us unreconstructed Keynesians, one certain way to increase demand for workers and put upward pressure on wages is significant, sustained increases in public spending to repair our crumbling infrastructure, attacking urban decay, and funding programs which will improve workers' skills to prepare them for good jobs that employers find difficult to fill. Finally, another approach to offsetting stagnant wage growth is to make greater use of a variety of programs to increase the non-earnings portion of low-wage workers' incomes. One example is to provide significantly more generous earned income tax credits. While incomes have stagnated for millions of low and moderate wage workers, the incomes of those at the upper end of the income distribution have significantly increased. Redistributing income from them via higher personal taxes strikes many of us as a fair way to share more equally the benefits of a modern industrial society, economy. The hymn is number 1017. Let's see what that hymn is called. Building a New Way.
This morning's question is, what does labor earn? And the definitive answer is, it depends. Depends on where you live, what you do, and on who you are. Education and experience, sure, but also your race, gender, and age are among the factors that affect income. Interesting how many factors affect earnings, and how little some of them have to do with the work itself. Not to sound too overly influenced by Marx, but there are two ways money gets made, through labor and through capital. And no matter what the job is that earns you money, if you're earning it through your own work, even if your work is reading and writing books, you're a laborer. Yet the word laborer brings up a whole different set of assumptions and constructs. What are the jobs that come readily to mind? Laborer. Miners, construction, carpentry, housekeepers. You know, and that's interesting. For the most part, when we say laborer, we don't really think about professors and doctors and lawyers or movie stars. Every year, Parade Magazine puts out an issue where they look at who makes what, and I am fascinated by it. Such a wide conglomeration of people and passions and such a wide disparity of incomes. They include superstar sports or entertainment icons whose takings are in the millions, and alongside cafeteria workers and yoga teachers. And while there's some sense to the differences in terms of education required, setting incomes side by side always pushes me to think about the reasons that they are not only illogical, but downright unfair. We readily recognize the unfairness of what you earn depending on factors about you, factors like race and gender, but it's pretty well established that they do. Anecdotally, I remember being employed in a setting, we'll call it Nameless University, where employees on the project that I was working on were forbidden to talk about their salaries. As it happened, surprise, the differences in salaries, if you looked simply at education and experience levels, were horrendous. In general, not universally, but in general, men made more than women, whites made more than blacks, and in part, those differences came because the women and blacks were consistently overeducated and experienced for the job titles they held, while the white men were sometimes undereducated and experienced for the job titles they held. And the people with the personal connections made the most money. They knew what they were doing, those folks making the rule that we shouldn't discuss salaries. Obviously, we did. If you can keep people in the dark about unfairness, they are far less likely to complain. Lily Ledbetter, whose case prompted the passage of the Fair Pay Act of 2009, didn't sue Goodyear until she found out how much less she was being paid. And according to the court, that was too late. She had accepted those lesser paychecks for too long. The 2009 law changed that inability to complain, but you still have to find out somehow. That old saying, what they don't know won't hurt them, is a lie. What you don't know can hurt really deeply. So how rigged is the system? To quote social commentary comedian John Oliver, wealth is dispersed as a lottery of birth. This country has gone from having some of the greatest social mobility in the world to one that is practically rigid. Economist Michael Carr at the University of Massachusetts recently completed a study of income change over life career and said, it is increasingly the case that no matter what your educational background is, where you start has become increasingly important for where you end. The general amount of movement around the distribution has decreased by a statistically significant amount. And yet, Americans continue to believe that if you work hard, you will do better. Let's get real. As the middle class collapses, the only mobility left is downward. In the last 30 years, the number of college-educated people living in poverty has doubled from 3 to 6%. And the number of high school-educated people in poverty has more than tripled from 6 to 22%. In the meantime, people who are doing well are doing really really well. For example, hedge fund managers, these are the guys who get to take advantage of the carried interest loophole to keep their taxes no higher than 20%. In 2014, the top 25 hedge fund managers made more than all the kindergarten teachers in the nation put together. The average salary for hedge fund managers, this isn't even the top guys, $2.4 million. It's hard for me to grasp. $2.4 million as a salary? And remember, they're not even the capital. It's not their money they're moving around. They are laborers hired to move other people's money around. Laborers. Don't even get me started on the capitalists. Now, I say that tongue-in-cheek. I do have money at work myself through retirement funds, for example. But what has happened? How has life shifted for Americans in the last half century? Of course, so much has changed in 50 years that it's hard to say exactly what's responsible for the growing bifurcation between rich and poor. Certainly, some of the factors that Michael mentioned, that tax laws, technology and globalization have contributed. I don't want to get into a blame game about it because it's complex. What is clear is that fewer people at the top have more of the money. A couple of years back, a video made the rounds showing how skewed wealth distribution was in the country. And what fascinated me is that it was not only more skewed than people thought it ought to be, it was way more skewed than people thought it was, even though they knew it was skewed. Now, here's the bottom line. The top 1% owns, depending on the source you recognize, 40 or 50% of the assets in the country, with more inequality since the Great Recession. Now, the top 1% is still some 3 million people. So let's put it on a scale that makes it clearer. The Forbes 400. The 400 richest families in the country have a net worth of $417 trillion. I'll give you a second for that to sink in. $417 trillion. And maybe some of you math people can correct me, but I think that's 12 zeros. If you arrange all the rest of Americans by their net worth and take the bottom 60% of households, they own less than the Forbes 400. Partly that's because a lot of people have a negative net worth. They owe a lot more than they have. So 75 million households together own less than the top 400. The gap between the rich and poor. You can't talk about gap. You can only talk about a huge chasm. Now, some of you are probably sitting there nodding, thinking, well, I knew I didn't have it. Others are shaking your head, wondering, how can that possibly be true? Now, people who are wealthy have the most ability to make money through their investments. They tend to have higher salaries when they are working, and they tend to have the most influence with elected officials. Capitalism tends to increase concentration of wealth unless factors like taxation or philanthropy intervene. I've played Monopoly. I know what happens. Now, most of us don't think these trends are desirable. Even Bill Gates, acknowledging that some level of inequality is built into the system, has asked, what level of inequality is acceptable? And when does inequality start to do more harm than good? There are significant trends on the lower ends of the wage scale. Opportunities have declined, not so much at the lowest point of the scale, where there's some low-wage service industry jobs. And the problem is these jobs don't pay enough to support a family, and they don't provide any benefits, including sick leave. They rarely have any flexibility in terms of working hours and sometimes demand overtime, so are difficult for parents trying to raise children, not to mention people trying to cobble together two or three jobs to make ends meet. Scheduling alone can be a nightmare. And what's more, they tend to be physically demanding jobs. I'm not just talking about farm workers, though they're in there, but nurses' aides who have to move patients safely, landscapers who work in the heat and cold or endure weeks of layoffs because of weather, restaurant servers who spend all day on their feet and carry heavy platters of food. And that's why federal disability exploded in the early part of this century, though such applications seem to have declined since 2010. Currently, nearly 9 million people receive Social Security disability. If an older, less educated worker can no longer stay on their feet all day, if their back doesn't allow them to lift and haul, what are they going to do? I heard a story on the radio show This American Life that considered the increase in disability claims, and one of the startling notions to me was the woman whose dream job was any job she could do sitting down. And the only person she had ever seen sitting down to work was the woman who processed her disability claim at Social Security. So if not at the very lowest end of the wage scale, what opportunities have declined? Well-paid jobs that don't require a lot of education have about dried up. Jobs from factory work to call centers, even some pretty technological jobs, moved to other countries, first Mexico, then China, India, Bangladesh, Vietnam. Or they've been replaced by technology. Meter readers, travel agents, file clerks, they've pretty much gone the way of lamplighters. And while there are fewer good jobs that require little education, the rate of high school graduation in this country, or for that matter of college graduation, is poor compared to other industrialized nations. And then there are the jobs that are little more than an excuse for exploitation. Michael sang this morning about the Spring Hill mine disaster. And we might think that doesn't happen anymore, but it was just last December that former Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship was found guilty of violating mine and safety standards. 29 miners had been killed in 2010 in an explosion in West Virginia that was his fault. The court said so. And he was fined only $250,000 and a year of probation. Because profits are valued more highly than lives. I can think of no other explanation. And economic exploitation of the poor by the rich is not limited to coal mines. It happens in nail salons and car washes and probably countless other places. Los Angeles alone sees $26.2 million of wage theft a week. People forced to work off the clock, give up their tips, or otherwise sacrifice money they are entitled to. Economic exploitation even happens at Walmart. The Walton family, which owns controlling interest of the company, about half the shares, they had $144.7 billion in 2013. That's equal to the wealth of the bottom 40-some percent of Americans. And people working for Walmart, doing the labor, receive $6.2 billion in government benefits. Food stamps, WIC, Section 8, Medicaid. This is according to Americans for Tax Fairness. Now, I don't begrudge them a cent of that. But I can't help believing that those workers are being exploited for profit. The Waltons could give up a shred of their profits for the benefits of their workers. And Walmart's easy to single out because they're such a titan, and the same thing is true of anyone hiring large numbers of low-wage workers. Let's think about it in the context of Riley County, Kansas. The living wage calculator developed by Amy Glassmeyer of MIT reports that a single parent with one child would need $21.21 to support themselves and their child here. $21.21 would be a living wage for a single parent with one child. Now, minimum wage falls short of that by $13.96. Essentially, a minimum wage single mother would need to make almost three times what she's making to survive reasonably here in this community. Even a single adult would need $10.63, short by $3.38 an hour of what they need. Nobody who's working should be in this position. And there's lots of other things. There's lots of other contributing factors. There's the factor of increased incarceration, particularly among people of color. People who go to prison have trouble getting work when they get out. And the rate of drug addiction is roughly the same as when Richard Nixon declared war on drugs, and all we've gotten out of it is a spate of damaged lives. With lessened opportunity, with schools in poorer neighborhoods that succeed mostly in encouraging kids to drop out, no wonder drug dealing and crime look like actual options to some people. Greater inequality is associated with more crime, more drug abuse, and more political inequality, eroding trust, increasing illness, and promoting excessive consumption. The cycle only gets worse. So, I've painted a pretty bleak picture. A diminishing middle class and a desperate lower class. The state of the nation this Labor Day is not good. My focus has been on this country, but we know the crisis is global. Pope Francis takes it further. He said the crisis is not only economic and financial, but is rooted in an anthropological and ethical crisis. I agree. Our views of humanity and what is expected of a moral person have been distorted by our focus on money. One problem with the story of woes I've recounted in this sermon is that it's only an economic view, and the economic view does not allow us to see the rest of the picture. We spend so much of our lives fixed in this economic view that we begin to regard people and things as only worthy when they produce money. Or as the Pope said, chasing the idols of power, profit, and money over and above the value of the human person has become a basic rule of operation and a decisive criterion of organization. It has been forgotten, and still we forget that above business logic and the parameters of the market lies human being, and that there is something owed to humans as humans in virtue of their profound dignity, the opportunity to live in dignity and to actively participate in the common good. Okay, so there's plenty on which you use and the Pope disagree, but we do agree that the opportunity to live in dignity and to actively participate in the common good should not be tied to economic value. In 2014, the UU General Assembly selected economic inequality as a congregational study action issue. Every other year, the GA comes up with an issue to consider association-wide for the next 4 years. So we're in the midst of this study of economic inequality. I wonder what's going to happen. People become less tolerant of inequality as they become more aware of it. This may sound not exactly on target, but I think this really says something. There was a recent study about air rage, okay? The phenomenon of people blowing up on airplanes, not blowing up airplanes like terrorism, but, you know, blowing up, getting angry, losing their temper, becoming belligerent. Researchers wanted to know the predictors of bad behavior. Seat size, flight delays, longer flights, all reasonable guesses and accurate. Two other predictors that you might not have thought of. Air rage triples on planes with a first-class section. What's more, it's seven times worse if economy passengers have to walk through first class to get to their seats. So everybody knows those people paid more for those seats. That's resentment. Resentment is growing. Even monkeys know unfair. Have you seen the video of the monkey who rejects the cucumber for a task when he sees another monkey get a grape for it? Google that, because it's really funny. primatologist Franz de Waal compared it to the Wall Street protests. And when I took economics back in the 1970s, my professor, like everyone else, was baffled because the situation that existed then, stagflation, inflation accompanied by lack of growth, was not supposed to happen. And the most valuable lesson I learned that semester was that sometimes the experts don't know. I appreciate having the view of an expert this morning, an economist, on the situation with wages here in the U.S. On the other hand, I don't believe we want to leave all our decisions in the hands of experts. Listen to these words from Whole Life Economics, Revaluing Daily Life, by Barbara Brand. It's commonly assumed that only highly trained professionals have the ability to understand the issues, the right to think about economic problems or come up with new solutions. As a result, many people feel powerless regarding the economy. This is reinforced by the fact that when experts talk about economics, they use esoteric technical jargon and complicated mathematical models. And most business and government leaders and media spokespeople talk about the health or weakness of the economy as if it were some abstract entity far removed from our daily lives. But the economy is not something out there, understandable only to the experts. You and I create economy every day in the course of our daily lives with our minds and bodies, our hearts and souls, our skills and dreams and values. We create the economy out of our feelings we have about ourselves and our own worth, through our relationships with each other, and through our connections to the natural world. And if we create the economy, this also means that we can change it through the activities of our daily lives so that it more fully meets our real needs and expresses our deepest values. The idea that we can change the economy so that it meets our needs and fits with our values is consistent with our own UU worldview. If justice is to be achieved, we have an obligation to strive for it. Why? Because we have an implicit covenant with one another and with the source of our being, capitalize that or not, depending on your theological orientation, a covenant with this world, even with the earth, a covenant that demands we act for justice. So the first theological foundation, we have to recognize that true security does not lie in a fat bank book. When we know that there is value beyond economic value, value in other people, value in the earth, it frees us to notice and esteem things other than money. Some sociologists tell us people who are working in lower class have traditionally relied more on family and friends than on money for security. Minister and teacher Tex Sample has studied the working class extensively, and he tells a story about an auto mechanic friend of his who repaired his truck for him. When Tex asked him what he owed him, he answered, "Why, nothing, Tex. That's what friends are for." So months later, Tex officiated at his friend's wedding, and when he asked what he owed him, Tex had to fight his middle-class conditioning, all those years of education, to be able to utter the words, "I pronounce you." He had to remind himself of his friend's values to come up with the correct response. Nothing. That's what friends are for. In those transactions between Tex and his friend, nothing registered in the GNP, as if nothing had happened. Economists might call it the informal economy because they can't measure it, but something important was built, more important than a monetary transaction, a deepening connection between two men from different stations in life who shared experience. This is an example of wealth, true wealth, coming from giving away what we have. A religious paradox, instead of an economic approach. One of the things that happens when we let loose of our narrow vision of value as economic is that we aspire not to a narrow good of self-interest, but to a common good. We work to build community. We know that if we lost everything, we would still have what matters. We strengthen our covenants. At the same time, we need to recognize the value of every single human being and know that every single one of them deserves and merits a chance, certainly a first chance, which many of our children are not getting now. Maybe even multiple chances. To my mind, that means everyone should be able to eat enough. Everyone should have access to clean water. Everyone should have access to education, to shelter, to ways to make meaning with their lives, and even to basic health care without causing them to go into bankruptcy. What's more, we need to be able to help one another in ways that are not patronizing, but that express the respect and value we accord each person. Okay, I'll quote the Pope once more. Not to share one's goods with the poor is to rob them and to deprive them of life. It is not our goods we possess, but theirs. I don't know what particular political policies or charitable organizations you should support based on that principle, but I think it's a sound principle. And I do have some ideas about what each of us can do. We need to support companies that reflect our values and pay a living wage. We need to treat all working people fairly, everybody we encounter. We need to treat people reasonably, politely. We need to tip well. Those people need the money. We need to not blame employees for their employers' mistakes. I think it's important to get an accurate idea of where we each fall on this continuum of wealth and income, to really understand, am I in the middle? Am I a little under? Am I a little over? Knowing that, not in a competitive way, but to know what is actually true when we start thinking about what we need or deserve, so that we can consider more than just our self-interest. What's reasonable and responsible for you and your family in terms of consumption and generosity? Because we need to give. We need to give to people and causes that we want to promote. We need to invest our money in ways consistent with our values. Politically, we need to work for change in policies around wages, taxations, benefits, things that will help decrease rather than increase income inequality. And we need to ask our representatives what their positions on those things are. And finally, individual efforts matter. But one of the principles I learned from organizing, including labor organizing, is that it's a lot more effective if we do things collectively. So at least some of these things could be collective actions. So that's some of my ideas. I think we could take about 5 minutes if people have burning comments or thoughts before I wind this one down.
I want to make a comment on unfair wages and stuff and labor practices. The reason why we should fix the immigration problem here is because the people who are not here legally are hired by many different companies, especially slaughterhouses, and the job's dangerous, and they don't get paid half the time. Well, they do get paid, but when they do get paid, it's very low, and if they complain, they get supported. So
they are often victims of wage theft.
Yeah,
they're often victims of wage theft.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I've left you all speechless.
Just to add to what Sabrina just said, even those the low-wage workers are at risk from other groups. And by that, what I mean is refugees who are allowed, who are legally here, are allowed to work, but are frequently hired by the same companies mm-hmm. that have these other low-wage workers. So the refugees come in and displace other workers who are at are in very fragile positions.
It's complicated. It's a very complicated and difficult situation, a lot of moving parts.
We had a woman staying with us recently whose immigration status remains murky, and we were very concerned about her. Miraculously, she found an apartment, got help moving her baggage into there, and it seems like a happy ending, but there are still these questions. What about work from now on? Mm-hmm. She has been able to buy meals. That makes you think she has more money than it seems as if she does have. And we would be interested in helping her in an ongoing way. So anybody has any thoughts, I'd like to have them.
Larry had it.
Spoken like a good son-in-law.
just a comment about the political dimension here. It's in what we see today, it seems to me, and this is not fellowship speaking, but one individual, that the current Democratic Party versus the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is on the side of justice, and the current Republicans are not. As I say, that's my opinion, not needn't be the fellowship's. However, I'd like to call our attention to the fact that historically this has not necessarily been the case. When Eisenhower, a Republican, was president, the top tax rate was in the 90%. John Kennedy, fine Democrat, started the race downward. To moving it down to the 60s. That downward trend was reversed by a Republican, George Herbert Walker Bush, when he famously broke his promise not to raise taxes and was mm-hmm. pilloried for doing so. So we can do the right thing and not feel that we are being partisanly political. Because both parties have some history here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the important things to keep in mind is that it really is true that people who have more money do have more access to political people. I mean, it just is true. They have more access.
I'll try to keep this short. I'm not typically talking twice in the same service. I have two competing thoughts in my head when I think about these issues. And the first one is that we do not exist in order to service an economy. We exist, and we have an economy because we have to have one. We need it. And it seems, intellectually speaking, like we ought to be able to arrange an economy that is fairer than the one that we have. Juxtaposed against that, though, is the greatest device for wealth creation that we seem to have found as a species is capitalism, which encourages not only wealth creation but wealth concentration. And I am simply unable to fit that square peg in that round hole. And I'm just always troubled by that, but that's sort of the terms in which I think of these things, and I'm usually feeling as though these terms are somehow limiting me and preventing me from conceiving of a solution to the problem.
Okay.
I appreciated, Kristen Corwin, I appreciated the story about air rage. I fly a lot, mm-hmm. and I think about the economy a lot when I'm on an airplane. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been thinking about lately is how during the Great Recession, the airlines were going out of business, and there were negotiations between labor and management mm-hmm. To keep the airlines in business. And the laborers, the pilots, who I would appreciate being well paid, and the flight attendants, they were being asked to give up money.
Yep.
And I thought, yes, come on, everybody's got to take a hit here. We got to keep the airlines going. We have to have airlines in our country. But now, I know that the airlines are incredibly profitable. I know that the cost of airplane tickets is going up and up. And I know that those concessions are not going away. And so what did we do? We made the airlines incredibly profitable for the capitalists, the owners. And I think about that, and I think about how wrong I was. And I wonder why it wasn't built into these agreements that when capital came back, the salaries would come back. And I feel sad about it every time I fly.
This will be the last comment.
Oh, well, just a little historical perspective locally. Manhattan had a living wage campaign that began roughly around 2000 and lasted off and on for a decade. With labor groups involved and also citizens groups. And at that time, the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship kind of sat on the sidelines, didn't give its official support. So I'm glad to see that in our congregations, it seems as if the tide has shifted there. And I'm glad to see that very much.
Thank you. So the point of this is not really to lay out what you should do, but to make you think about your own efforts to accord worth in your life, what is worthy, and how do you act consistent with your values. So human worth, the worth of the earth, these are things that need to inform my work and my generosity, because if we consider people of value only when their net economic worth merits it, then we're dismissing children, elders, people with disabilities, people of color, and increasingly young adults. But more, we're dismissing people with abilities, with dreams, with passions, with inherent worth and dignity. And so may we always keep before us our highest values and never forget what our lives are worth committing to. Our closing song is printed on the insert in your order of service. It's a good old union song for Labor Day, a rousing one, so rise in body or spirit as we sing.
We'll sing the refrain and then verse and then refrain and verse, refrain four times, five, something like that. Okay.
By the wall.
closing words, I invite everyone to a potluck in the Alsop room out that way. And whether you brought something or not, I'm sure there'll be plenty of food. So, words of Wendell Berry. The love and work of friends and lovers belong to the task and are its health. Rest and rejoicing belong to the task and are its grace. Let tomorrow come tomorrow. Not by your will is the house carried through the night.